Bath time was great for adults as well as babies. I plopped a bath bomb into a pool of steaming water and hopped right in. I am living the fucking dream right now. No wonder Wes loves bath time so much. I am the Richard Branson of bath time. I am a bath CEO. These essential oils are sending me to space and back, Virgin Galactic, where are you at? I can't really imagine this as a nightly ritual, but it was certainly a nice time to think and relax while I lavished in the sweet scent of lavender.
I don't even have a bathtub, nor do I have Epsom salts or know what that even is.
This is a hilarious idea that I have no intention of completing. I don't have a sexy enough bath or Epsom salts. And on top of that, the idea of bathing as relaxation has never been attractive to me. Even luxuriating in a shower seems like an awful waste of my precious time and the Earth's water. Instead, I eat dinner, which usually would be an enormous smorgasbord I'd collect from the nearby Whole Foods or a delivery order of mukbang that's far too large for one person to handle. Today was different, though, and the presence of my hipster avocado toast and Mark Wahlberg sandwich chugging down my intestinal tract led me to quickly toss together a bowl of brown rice, a couple of fried eggs, and soy sauce. That's doing it dirty Asian style. After I'd scarfed down the meal, I pumped a silent fist into the air.
Yes!
3 square meals for the first time in a very long stretch of shitty eating habits? If this CEO day has taught me anything, it's that a regular and balanced 3-meal day is standardized for a good reason. I felt positively refreshed.
10 p.m. Change into clothes dedicated specifically to sleep and nothing else.
Just call them pajamas. Just, they have a name already. You don't have to explain what they are. There's a uniform name we all use for dedicated sleeping clothes. It's called pajamas, or PJs.
I think we broke Keith.
Yeah, I don't think Keith likes this either.
I imagine dedicated sleeping clothes come with, like, a sleeping cap. I don't know. I usually wear boxers and a soft t-shirt to bed, so I changed into those. Does that count? Maybe I need to get dedicated sleeping clothes. A matching pajama set with Ariel.
I sleep naked. So I enjoy
the... What? Really?
I sleep naked. So I enjoyed this part thoroughly, but I did get yelled at for walking by an open window.
I didn't know you were a naked sleeper, too. Yeah.
You sleep naked? Is that a normal thing?
I can't do it. What if my dick walks away?
Your dick can't walk away.
It could, because I'm asleep and I'm not watching it.
But it's okay, because he's undercover.
Oh.
So, I sleep in my underwear, if in anything at all. Pajamas or sleeping clothes make me think of white couples from the 1950s who slept in separate twin beds.
Hey.
Without going into any further detail, I'm basically naked from here on out. My sleep clothes are a birthday suit.
10:15 p.m. Drink chamomile or lavender tea.
Oh, but I thought my clothes were only for sleeping. So these are now tea clothes, or tea is a sleep activity. I'm sorry, CEO, I called you out on your bullshit. I'm in dedicated sleeping clothes, so fuck your tea.
Wow, Keith.
I don't think I can follow that.
Hey, Ned, drink chamomile or lavender tea.
Okay, Mom, sure.
So this was a first for me since the idea of tea, or any typically caffeinated beverage for that matter, imbibed for relaxation instead of jazzification, was not something I would have expected to be on this list. However, after noticing how uniquely slumberous I was feeling after restricting my coffee intake later in the day, and the aforementioned 3 square meals, I dug up an old sleepy time tea box. Again, much of my aversion to some of these measures, like the same boring-ass outfit and the sleeping clothes and the evening tea, are due to me associating them with weird older individuals who maybe live in England and knit for kicks. But the tea
did indeed make me more torpid, and I was yawning before I knew it.
10:30 p.m. Write down the things that you're grateful for today.
Well, I'd say that my CEO day has been a complete and utter failure. You know, I started out very hopeful in the morning. I had this nice breakdown schedule to follow, and then I just totally fucked up every hour's goal. I should have known that trying to adapt to someone else's lifestyle in one day was really not going to work, especially right now in this weird time of everyone is doing everything at this company. You know, we're all CEOs right now, but also none of us are CEOs, you know? Really, I guarantee that none of the other guys were able to do this either, so I'm not super upset.
I'm grateful that we own our own business. It's been a dream of mine since I watched The Social Network. No, but honestly, I've worked so many jobs over the years, and I've always wanted to have this sense of control and autonomy, the high risk but high reward of calling all the shots. I'm grateful that I have my three best friends all in it with me, with everyone incredibly committed and passionate about building something big and exciting. I'm grateful that I have a hilarious, fascinating wife who I love spending time with and an adorable baby who together ground me and make CEO Day still feel like Dad, Husband, Family Day.
CEO Day was stressful and not a total success from start to finish, but I took from it a ton that I hope to integrate into the normal flow of my work life moving forward. All these methods are ultimately about productivity, because efficiency leads to balance. Balance in how you work, and more important, balance in how you live. It's so easy to forget why we work. My happiness has been so hopelessly intertwined with my output that I'd forgotten why I do any of this to begin with. Life isn't about work, and success doesn't magically make you happier. I honestly feel like I need that knitted into a sign to hang over my nightstand.
Put it on a t-shirt.
I would love that. I would wear that t-shirt. Tryguys.com? I still love work, and dare I say, I'm obsessed with it. I think that's awesome. I love what I do, and I'm beyond fortunate to be able to look forward to work every single day. I love telling stories, and that will always be a part of me. But it doesn't have to be the whole of me. This experiment didn't dissuade me from wanting to work harder. It simply taught me how to work smarter. Along the way, it also reminded me that there are other things in my life just as important, if not more so. When I look back at my life 50 years from now, how will I have wished I spent my time?
I'm grateful that I was able to learn valuable insights, not only about how to work and lead a company more effectively, but also how I can improve all aspects of my daily life, since so many harmful habits are tied directly to the way you approach school or employment. Some of the more important insights were setting clear times for particular meetings and endeavors, scheduling our personal tasks more definitively, and limiting outside distractions such as browsing emails and social media. On the other hand, as for guys who have struggled with maintaining a healthy work-life balance in the past, perhaps there's a deeper poignancy to be learned from this try, right? Being a successful CEO requires a certain amount of sacrifice. Perhaps there are times when that's necessary, and maybe there will be other moments when we should learn how to step away, relinquish some control, and value the betterment of our health and lifestyle. A balance between being the best bosses we can be while becoming better people, even outside of the office, should be aimed for. And if the CEO schedule was one rigid path to success, then we should learn how to forge our own unique one that allows for more twists and turns, but still leads to the same goal.
That was lovely, Eugene.
Thank you, Mary.
10:45 p.m. Go to sleep.
Go to hell.
Fuck yeah, boy! I need it!
As you wish.
I climb into bed, expecting for it to take forever, and think about how long Mr. Sandman will ignore me this time. Boom. I'm out like a light.
What we learned!
Take care of yourself.
What you eat and drink and how much you sleep and exercise can have enormous effects on your productivity.
Set a schedule and try to stick to it. Having at least some structure in your day can minimize the amount of time you waste on Instagram.
But also, procrastination is a good thing. Your brain needs a break every once in a while.
Remember, you work to live, not the other way around. Thinking about why you are putting in those long hours working for the man can give you much needed perspective.
Yeah! And that's how you read a book. Chapter 5. Love. The original title of this book was The Try Guys Are All Really Good at Doing Sex Stuff. But our publisher told us that it was a little too narrow and also not true. Okay, fine. But when it comes to dating, the four of us have all been unlucky in love at some point in our lives. Fortunately, we've also been very lucky in love. Two of us are married. One of us is in a very serious, long-term, cohabitating relationship. And the other is Eugene. Having a significant other really makes everything in life better. Food tastes better. The sun shines brighter. Except when you get into a fight with your sigiyuz. We're trademarking that. In which case, everything gets much, much worse. Food tastes terrible. The sun, I guess in this analogy, turns dark and cold and everything dies. At least, it can feel that way when things are not going well with your sigiyuz. I'm so sorry that we came up with that abbreviation. So, we're gonna tell you about our breakups and makeups, and all the ways we are not the ideal boyfriend slash husband. It's going to be painful to explore the most intimate aspects of our love lives, but we will do it so that you can find that special someone in your life. Please, just invite us to the weddings. Let's get Siggy with it. What's wrong with us? Oh boy, dating. For years, romance evaded me entirely. I wasn't exactly a hot catch growing up, despite the serious Dwight Schrute vibes I was given off. My childhood was stuffed to the brim with unrequited love and one-sided crushes, which extended deep into my 20s. I filled my adolescence with as many sappy romantic movies as time would allow, and I roamed the elementary school hallways wondering who would end up being the Sally to my Harry. When I fell hard. I'm talking scribbling names in the corner of my notebook, role-playing fantasies with my stuffed animals, lying in bed and imagining what our future children would be like. One daughter, one son, and a few more children we adopt in later years. Usher came out with the song You Got It Bad when I was 11 years old, and I was like, hot damn, Usher, you get me. Months would go by, and despite hopelessly crushing on girls, I was always too afraid to actually say anything of substance to them. If movies taught me anything, it was that relationships are founded on big, sweeping declarations of love. But I seem to miss the parts where the characters, you know, actually talked to one another. In fourth grade, it was Lisa Barkley. Lisa was the prettiest girl in the class, with mesmerizing eyes, flowing blonde hair, and a warm smile. A normal thing for me to think at the time, but admittedly uncomfortable to say out loud about a child as an adult man. Yeah. Lisa was dating Doug. Everyone knew it. They were the hot couple of the year. But that wasn't about to stop me, because I loved Lisa, and I knew that she would feel the same about me. So, in preparation for Valentine's Day, a little on the nose, I know, I convinced my mom to drive me to the mall so I could buy items to assemble into a gift bag for Lisa. I put together a basket with the best candy allowance could buy, with an oh-so-cute teddy bear sitting in the middle. If memory serves, I also gave her a handwritten letter, proudly revealing my feelings. Looking back, I can easily recognize this as a slow-moving train wreck, and shame on my mother for encouraging me. I marched into school, a skip in my step and the cumbersome gift basket cradled in my twig-like arms. This was my moment. The moment. "Hi, Lisa," I heard myself squeak, a mix between that pained whisper you let out when your back hurts and the dying cry of a mouse in the clenched jaws of a house cat. She turned and faced me. I wished her a happy Valentine's Day and handed her my basket, which she accepted with a surprised smile. "Oh, thank you," she said. And then we never spoke of that moment ever again for the next 8 years we were in school together. Fucking swept her right off her feet, young Casanova. Footnote, Young Casanova is available as a follow-up mixtape to Hebrew School Dropout. While Lisa accepted my gift, she did not jump into my imaginary red convertible so we could drive away together into the sunset. My romantic gesture fizzled and left me empty-handed, and that ember inside my heart dimmed, as it did in seventh grade when I tried the Valentine's Day sweep her off her feet with a bear move again, this time with Jennifer D. Or in 11th grade when I tried to score some weed for Wendy B. By the end of high school, I had to accept reality. Grand romantic gestures are not my forte. College would be different, I told myself. But years of quiet rejections encased me with a sheen of fear. I crushed from a comfortable distance, projecting what I wanted my crushes to be, but not getting to know them for the people they really were. I put all these emotional eggs in a basket, and when girls didn't just magically like me back, I was devastated. It was totally unfair, both to myself and to the girls I was attracted to, but that was my reality. I got through college without ever entering into a real relationship. Look, I wasn't a total square. I had a lot of fun, and not totally infrequently. But when things got too serious, the emotional memory of rejection would take over and hold me back. To combat it, I applied a limit to my relationships. A firm do-not-cross threshold that protected me from any form of vulnerability, but also served to stunt my growth as a person. I left college with a degree and an emotional debt that not even Sally Mae wanted to collect. I went from hopeless romantic to just hopeless. And that's where I stayed for a few years. In the absence of a relationship, I threw myself into work. The novelty of being single but busy worked well for years, but by my mid-20s, I was, well, lonely. My dating life would follow a regular pattern. I'd decide I want to get back out there, re-download the apps, go on a series of dates for a few weeks, meet someone, watch as our relationship dissolved over the next few months, and then retreat into a cocoon of not dating where no one can hurt me. In the few dates I got, neither of us would prioritize the other. Most of the time, women would ghost me, or sometimes, I would get too busy with work and ghost them. I know. If we couldn't find time for at least 3 dates in a month, I knew it wouldn't pan out. A cloud of insecurity pursued me. I didn't just dread that I was a bad partner. I was pretty damn sure of it. This overarching fear of rejection or fear of disappointing someone if they ever expressed interest in me, pushed others away. Closer inspection, and time, has shown me that it all boils down to confidence. I was afraid to fail, and afraid that I wasn't good enough. Because, as we've covered, failing sucks. It hurts. It's awkward. It's embarrassing. But if you're too afraid to fail, then you're too afraid to live. So, at the tender age of 25, I decided to fail in dating as hard as I could. Mind you, this was almost 3 years before we solidified our Try Guys philosophy, so I would like the record to state that I definitely invented this and deserve all the credit for this book. The plan was simple. I needed to put myself out there. The first step to failing at dating, it turns out, is to actually talk to people. So that's what I did. Every weekend, I made it my job to talk to one girl who I thought was out of my league. The way to meet new people, as it turns out, isn't all that different from the way that you connect with friends in real life. Ask questions, listen, and find common interests. The first few rejections hurt like hell, especially when they were in public. Oh my god. When a stranger is not immediately receptive to you, it can be humiliating. It feels like everyone is watching you, and that she's not just rejecting you, but your entire family and everything you hold dear. Your sweat glands start squirting their defense spray, and your face turns that unique shade of red the body for some reason produces just to advertise your ineptitude. But with each consecutive whiff, the impact softens. Online dating was especially useful during this period. For some reason, people still seem to look down on dating apps, but I am here to tell you, they're amazing. We meet people where we spend most of our time, and in the 2010s, we spend a lot of our time on our phones. There is nothing weird about dating apps. Say it louder for the people in the back. Yet, old Zach on dating apps was as high-strung as they come, scrutinizing every incoming message, hunting in their profile photos for clues, and endlessly drafting and redrafting messages in an effort to say the perfect thing to sweep them off their feet, whatever that means. Of course, my anxiety led me to achieve the exact opposite. With hours in between messages, I thwarted the chance of any semblance of flow. I was less concerned with connecting and more with just saying the right thing, whatever that means. And worst of all, I was letting fear dictate my behavior. Just as in real life, flirting on a dating app requires a reckless sense of abandon and an overall attitude of not caring. Not in the blasé, unaffected sense, but coming for a place where you're not just unafraid to fail, you actually welcome it with open arms. If you're anything like me, you probably forgot that dating is supposed to be fun. So have fun! Ask them their favorite Beyoncé song. Everyone has an opinion about Beyoncé. Tell them an embarrassing childhood memory, or see if you can get advice on an absurd fabricated problem, like there's a cat loose somewhere in your walls and you can hear it meowing at night. I dare you to find the limit. You're not gonna scare someone away by saying one wrong thing, and if you do, then I can guarantee that you weren't gonna make it past the first date together anyway. Both in real life and online, you have to learn how to not give a shit and just have fun. I should take a moment to acknowledge that this strategy absolutely did not always work for me, but that's okay because it helped me grow. Failing and realizing my worst fears of rejection showed me that it really isn't all that bad. Ultimately, you rub some dirt on the wound and you move on. and hope that it doesn't get infected. Please, under no circumstances, rub dirt on your real wounds. Trying to fail, intentionally going in without the aim of succeeding and just allowing myself to have fun, ironically handed me the keys to success. For the first time in my life, meeting people was enjoyable because I wasn't nervous about the outcome. Put another way, I learned to stop worrying about consequences and just live in the moment. Some nights I'd put on a fake accent and see how long it would take for people to realize I wasn't really Russian. Drunk people have terrible gauge for fake accents. Some nights were just about getting on the dance floor and going nuts with my friends. And wouldn't you know, those were always the nights we made the most new friends. The more I tried to seem cool, whatever that means, the worse the results. The moment I loosened up and allowed myself some fun, the world opened at my fingertips. Not caring meant I found myself in more positive situations. It meant that I was only putting my best self forward, and all the wonderful aspects of my personality were finally able to flourish, untethered by that voice in my head that was afraid to be embarrassed. Over the course of a year, it stopped feeling so risky and scary. And look, this didn't just happen in a vacuum. It coincided with the rising popularity of our show, and being on camera definitely played a role in making me more self-assured and comfortable in my own skin. Getting a better fashion sense was also key, as you heard about how hot I was in Chapter 3. All this effort ended up preparing me for the moment I was waiting for. When the girl of my dreams entered my life, I was ready.
When Keith met Becky. When I was a senior at Illinois State University, ISU, there was a freshman named Becky whom I was friendly with. At Christmas, my improv group, the ISU Improv Mafia, cool name, I know, threw a party called Blastmas. It was a secret Santa, but every single gift was booze. We had this bit where we would unwrap the gift pretending that we didn't know it was going to be alcohol and then get really excited that it was our favorite alcohol. It was a silly excuse to have a party with too much booze, but it was still important that we wrapped it and made a fun experience because we improv folk like theme events. This being college, there were underage people there who had to figure out how to both buy liquor and get it wrapped. On the day of the party, people would sometimes show up at our apartment and drop off their booze so it could be in the fridge and they didn't have to worry about it. My roommates liked Becky, so they invited her to Blastmas, and the more the merrier, I thought. Becky got someone to buy her booze, and when she came over to my apartment to drop it off, I asked if she was going to wrap it. "I don't have any wrapping paper," she said. And I snapped back with, "Well, you should go get some and wrap it. It has to be wrapped." There was some back and forth about how she didn't think it mattered, and I told her that it did, that it was my party, and that's how the party worked. She said it was hard enough for an underage person to get alcohol, and I said, "That's not an excuse." I could have been nicer, could have offered to help wrap it for her, but I chose to be a jerk instead. Ha ha. I didn't think much about the exchange, but Becky remembered it, apparently, forever. And she held a grudge against me for the rest of the year, and then the next year or two after that. And since the party was related to my improv group, I think she decided that she would also hold a grudge against all the other dumb bits that we like to participate in. To this day, she still hates our stupid drink cheer, Zebra Stripes, Down the Pipes. And now that I think of it, I bet we did overwhelm her with that ditty throughout that party that she hated. After graduation, I had both a whirlwind of a time and a very poor dating track record. I started touring with Mission Improbable, a comedy troupe, where we'd travel to colleges to perform shows almost every night of the week, only to have 3 days off and then head out again for a few weeks. The grueling schedule made it impossible to maintain a relationship and contributed to my breaking up with the girl I was dating at the time. In 2011, I came back to ISU for the Improv Mafia Funeral Show, which is the last show for that year's seniors, where they are roasted in a sweet send-off. Sometimes alumni come back to roast the seniors as well. I did a bit where I imitated one of Becky's friends who happened to be dating one of the seniors we were roasting. Somehow, that silly portrayal, combined with a couple years' maturity and a nice haircut, was enough to change Becky's opinion of me. She told my friend she thought I was cute. I told my friend I thought Becky was cute. And then we were off. I messaged Becky on Facebook, super romantic, and proceeded to court her the only way I knew how. Sending her funny videos that I had made online, weird, low production value sketches, confusing comedy music videos, and long and poorly edited improv shows. What was I thinking? It says a lot about Becky that she was kind enough to go on a date with me even after that barrage of self-promotion. The first few dates that Becky and I had were very sweet, but neither of us could read each other. I was sure she only kinda liked me, not liked me, so I didn't make any real moves. I also only took her to hot dog restaurants. Then, after a few months of dating, I suggested she celebrate her 21st birthday at a bar close to me. And then, I didn't even show up. And one time, I didn't walk her back to her train stop because I thought it was insulting to assume she needed someone to escort her. So basically, I almost blew it 100 times. Then on my birthday, I invited her to a party, and in my mind, I was like, I don't know if she likes me, but I'm just gonna try to kiss her because it's my birthday. Apparently, she also came to that party with the mindset of, I don't know if he likes me, but I'm gonna try to kiss him because it's his birthday. So at some point outside in the alley behind the party, we kissed for the first time, and I pulled away and romantically said, I like how you have kind of a big mouth, because I also have a big mouth. Yes, that is what I said to her after finally kissing after 2 months of bizarre courtship. And we've been together ever since.
How I Met Your Mother, as told to Wesley. Featuring Ariel!
Me!
Yay!
Hi, Wesley. I know you're only a few months old, but it's time you hear the most important story in the world. Because without this story, you wouldn't exist. Pay attention, because this is the story of How I Met Your Mother.
We love you so much, little one. And of course, I will be here, filling in the details.
Just in case I, you know, don't tell it right.
Making sure your dad is telling all the truth.
Me and your mom met in Chicago in the winter of 2009 through a mutual friend named Becca. Becca was one of my close college friends and one of your mom's coworkers. On this particular night, Becca was having a birthday party, the kind of party where 9 or 10 people sit in a big circle and talk. I came into the circle and I was sitting on the complete opposite side from your mom.
Dad was late to the party.
I was?
And you brought a half a bottle of tequila.
I could have sworn it was red wine.
No, it was definitely tequila.
I'm a classy broad. I bring red wine.
No.
All right, well, I guess I brought a half-drunk bottle of tequila, trying to pawn it off on my friend Becca.
Great first impression.
Yeah, great first impression. Anyway, I sat down and immediately noticed Mom on the other side of the room. I thought to myself, who is that? I did not know Becca had such gorgeous friends. Eventually, we started talking to each other, leaning forward across the circle, making everyone listen to our conversation. We learned about how we both love to travel the world, and both loved camping and being outdoors. Your mom had gone to high school in London, which I thought was so cool, and she actually took a year off from college to hike across Costa Rica. I was fascinated by her. I just had to get to know her more. Over the course of the evening, little by little, I worked myself around the circle until I was sitting right next to her. I remember thinking she was so funny and charming and beautiful that I just had to get to know her more. Yet, at the end of the night, I completely forgot to get her phone number. Were you expecting me to ask you? Did that cross your mind?
I mean, I definitely, like, thought about it later, thought to myself, well, you know, that would have been cool, but, you know, I didn't really expect it.
Yeah, I was like, how am I going to get in contact with this beautiful angel ever again? I remember thinking, I blew it. She's gone. She's gone. I blew it. She's gone.
I mean, you could have just called Becca.
Well, I know, but that would have been so direct.
Uh-huh.
In any case, I did ask Becca in like kind of a roundabout way. I said to Becca, hey, your friend Ariel, she was like super cool, right? We should all hang out again, like as a group, and you bring Ariel.
You know, like all of us.
Like all of us, but like Ariel will be there and I'll be there, and it'll be like this fun, like big group hang.
So she invited us to a trivia night.
Yeah. And so over the course of several trivia nights.
I'm pretty sure it was just one trivia night.
Just, what's, did we go to trivia like all the time?
No, there was one night where you saved me a seat.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, yes. There was the trivia night. That was the one where I got there 15 minutes early. I saved Ariel the seat. And she got there 15 minutes late.
Well, first of all, I wasn't 15 minutes late, but it was a pretty big deal that you would save me a seat.
Was I just super early?
I think you were just really, really excited.
I was just like really stressed about this group date.
I was like on time.
I knew you. I remember I was like, I fended off 6 or 7 people that wanted to sit in this seat. I mean, I was sweating bullets over here. I remember I dressed up all nice. I like got my very nice scarf. My scarf. I got
your one nice scarf.
Yeah, I had one nice scarf and I wore it. So I was like, oh, she might think I have a nice scarf. When your mom walked in, she was behind her roommate. I remember that. It was like she was separated from me and my seat that I had saved. But then she saw that I had the seat open right next to me. She did a full-on NFL swim move to get past her roommate.
I don't remember it quite that way, but I definitely did push in front of my roommate.
Yeah, you just moved right by her.
And I walked up and I said, hello, Ned.
And I said, hello, Ariel. Fancy meeting you here.
But do you remember the walk to the train?
Oh, of course. We were walking, just the two of us, and you turned to me and...
Well, I said, how are you?
Yeah. How are you?
How are you?
In that special way that I could tell you really cared about me. And I cared about you.
I feel like we're telling the story of when you know, you know.
It's true. When you know, you know. I used to not believe in love at first sight. I thought it was a silly thing invented for rom-coms and fairy tales. But truly... this was it. After that, our relationship moved very quickly. We were going on dates, and then we were going over to each other's houses nearly every evening of the week. Usually Ariel's house, because my house was, like, pretty tiny and always cold. I don't know why the heat didn't really work that well.
He also had a twin-size bed.
Yeah.
For, like, some reason, like, we were still in college. I guess we were not even 6 months out of college at that point, but I had a full-size bed.
Very important. Actually, 4 months into dating, we decided to move in with each other.
That was pretty nuts.
Yeah, it seemed fast, but I know you might think it's quick, but we knew there was something special between us. That first summer, we went to South Africa together for the World Cup. I love our adventures together. We've been so many places. We've been to Brazil and China, Hong Kong, Paris. Each trip is an unforgettable adventure with my best friend.
Oh,
you are my best friend.
You're my best friend.
No, stop it. We're reading an audiobook. People can't be listening to this.
You stop it.
Oh, my God. Anyways, we were talking about South Africa. Yeah, so that first trip to South Africa, it was nearly a month long, and it was a true test of our burgeoning relationship. Because there were sublime moments, like when we saw baby elephants walk by us, steps away from our rental sedan in Kruger National Park.
I thought they were going to trample the car.
Oh, yeah. It's like, why do they just let you drive your rental car onto the game park?
Ridiculous.
It's crazy. But it was exciting and special. Or when we were in Cape Town watching the sunset from the cliffs. But there was also the challenges of being alone in a foreign country. Like when I got food poisoning from some very spicy lamb curry and your mom had to pull over for me to vomit every hour on the hour of a 12-hour long car trip from Durban to Port Elizabeth.
That drive, we were supposed to share the driving.
Yes.
But I ended up having to drive the whole way. Which wasn't bad.
You are my hero. Let me just say that. That was, I mean, I was in a pretty bad state.
And you were.
You drove that entire way. Or there was when our taxi driver took us on a shocking detour to a dusty shanty town in Soweto to drop off a mysterious package. There were so many things that I remember thinking during the trip, if we can make it through this wild adventure, there's nothing we can't handle.
It's so true. That's when we knew.
We knew. That's when we knew. Only 9 months into our relationship, we got engaged. I remember that day, the day that I asked Ariel to marry me, I was at my desk, at work. I remember feeling this overwhelming sensation that if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, I'd want your mom to know the way I felt about her that day. I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was something that I wanted to tell her right now. So, in the middle of the day, I left work. I said I had a family emergency, and so I went, I got a haircut, and I bought some flowers. Then I walked into a ring store, but walked out because it didn't quite feel right. To get truly the perfect ring, I would need to consult with your mom.
Of course.
Of course. Can't just be buying any old ring. Need the expert opinion.
That's right.
And then, after that, I wrote a long, tear-stained, completely incoherent note about how much she meant to me and how much I loved her. Then I put on a suit, and I surprised her at her office. It was a Wednesday, and Wednesday is date night. So she was expecting me, but she wasn't expecting a suit and flowers.
I was wondering what was going on. It felt special. It felt different.
I was barely holding it together. I mean, any time I thought about her or thought about what she meant to me, I was about to start tearing up. And if I cry, I can't actually ask her to marry me. It's like, you gotta be able to get the words out of your mouth. That was actually going through my head. I was like, just hold it together. If she doesn't know what you're trying to ask, then it'll be very confusing for her.
So at that point, I came out of my office and I said, why are you wearing a suit?
Right. As like all of your coworkers are looking through the window. And then
And then you broke down.
I lost it. I completely lost it. I got down on one knee and I told her how incredibly special she was to me and how I realized earlier that day I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. And then I asked her to marry me.
And I said, oh my God, are you serious?
To which I replied, yeah.
And I said, of course, yes.
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 Yes. And then we held each other for a long time. Later that evening, I remember calling our friends and their family.
Telling them all the good news. And of course, they knew we had something special, too.
I had just turned 23 when we got engaged. I was one of the first of my friends to get married, but it never felt strange. It never felt like it was too soon. It always just felt right and natural.
Like it was just an expression of how we felt about each other.
Yeah. We had a very long engagement, almost 2 years, which was so fun because wherever you go, when you say you're engaged, people are the most excited. We really savored that time. That was just the best. It was the best. Yeah. I remember we took a whole road trip up the California coast. Everywhere we stayed, we said it was our engagement trip. We got several free bottles of champagne and many chocolates. By the time we actually got married at age 25, other people were getting engaged and married as well. Really, when I think about every big milestone we've had, between getting engaged, getting married, getting a dog together, having a baby together, I wouldn't say either of us was totally ready for it. We just knew it was the right time.
I don't think you're ever ready. And we also just trust each other. We trust that we can do it, and we always figure it out.
We do. That trust is so important.
Wes, do you remember when I wrote about that horrific knee injury in Chapter 2? Pretty bad, right? Well, that was actually only 4 months into our marriage. Your mom stayed with me for a month in Boston while I was recovering at my grandparents' house. That was so difficult and so stressful for us early on. But we came out the other side stronger and even more in love. Relationships take work, they take effort, they don't happen naturally, and you have to continually make an effort to respect each other and to be kind to each other. I have no idea who I would be and where I would be without your mom. She is so much a part of who I am. We're just a part of each other.
I wouldn't want to know what I'd be like without your dad. And I wouldn't want to know what he'd be like without me.
We're so grateful to have each other. And now, Wesley, we are so grateful to have you.
We are so grateful to have you.
Sweet little Wes. I love you, Ariel.
I love you too, honey.
And we love you, Wesley.
So much.
The 25-year-old virgin. I lost my virginity when I was 25 years old. This revelation came as a shock to our viewership when I casually revealed it in the video, Which Try Guy Knows Eugene the Best? Many assumed that I was a freewheeling, promiscuous lush who must have had a tsunami of sexual partners. Quite the contrary. Much of my delayed blooming was due to the adversity I dealt with when coming to terms with my sexuality. First, let's get one thing straight, pun intended. I have an inherently distrustful view of the concept of love. You might even go as far as to label me the anti-Ned. My parents' marriage was so unhappy and fraught with cultural politics and unnecessary sacrifice that when they divorced when I was in middle school, the first emotion I felt was relief. They were essentially expected to stay with one another, regardless of how they felt, because Asians are oftentimes raised with a sense of duty and position over personal preference. It was never fair to expect them to stay together if it was devoid of love. I can say with confidence that many parents I've met from more traditional cultures are simply sticking it out with absolutely zero passion left, if any was present to begin with. Love, to me, could be a performative act, and it could easily be fallen out of just as easily as couples dive into it. I attend friends' weddings and am moved by the romance and the ceremony, but never have I believed that a pair's ties are invulnerable. Shit happens. People change. Bravo to those success stories, few and far between, blissful in their geriatric years. But I'm not banking on it. To a queer teenager in the conservative South, I was mortified by my developing sexuality, paralyzed by the reckoning I was sure would rain fire upon me should my family or community ever find out. Already having to deal with my otherness as an Asian kid, I bottled up my urges and identity, using the excuse to both friends and parents that I wasn't interested in dating because I was too engrossed by my work and future career. I was, if anything, decidedly asexual to my peers. But behind closed doors, I was combating exceedingly awful thoughts about how hopeless my situation was. I was convinced I would be closeted forever and that hearts, something I already felt skeptical about, were not in the hand I was dealt. A few of my closest friends would find out by the time I was a senior and were wonderful confidants to entrust my problems to. But there wasn't much I could do besides keeping it under wraps and preoccupying myself with homework and hobbies. It was all spades for me as I shuffled a deeper, darker hole in my depressed mind that would serve as my hiding place until I came out after graduating from high school. Since there was barely anyone I could talk to about this for years, the admission burst out of me when I visited my mother in Paris, where she lived after she divorced my father. She told my dad, and my sisters eventually found out as well. I went to college in the very gray area every LGBT person knows all too well. My parents weren't totally on board the rainbow train, mainly because they hadn't seen any proof of my sexual preferences. I wasn't sure how to act around the other young, virile people I was meeting anew. One might assume that attending USC was the tipping point in my tragic tale of self-discovery, where I began dating and fell in love and started to finally experience all the magical, salacious things I gawked at on teen dramas. Although I did become infinitely more comfortable with my sexuality and found a lasting support system, as I encourage any LGBT students to seek should they be coming out during college, I was unexpectedly confronted with a racial discourse as an Asian male that I wasn't prepared to engage in healthily. The predominantly white, cisgendered LGBT youth culture in LA was equally as damaging for me as a person of color as was getting picked on in the South. I was accepted into certain higher social echelons of gay friends because I was deemed both attractive and masculine enough, clearly the exception to most LGBT Asian guys. I was prized for being antithetical to my community's deeply ingrained racial sexual tendencies. I was tall, wide-jawed, straight-acting, and aggressive, nothing like the preconceived notions many of my new acquaintances had about Asian men. The unchecked racism at the time in the West Hollywood parties that served as the environment of my coming out further pushed me into a dark mental place. I was suspicious and defensive. When anyone asked me out on a date, I would assume an underlying racial component to their attraction that led me to turn them down. I refrained from dating at all until I was 24, and even then, I technically only went on a few first dates. If Texas fucked me up, Los Angeles fucked me over. But by the time I joined the Try Guys, I was as relatively well-adjusted as someone who spent most of their life refusing what even the faintest glimmer of love can be. By relying on my talent and carefully crafted, charming persona, I had navigated most social and professional situations without letting them know I was a virginal, conflicted, depressed shell of a human. But, in a strange twist of fate, that persona I convinced myself I was engineering was, in fact, my real magnanimous self simply emerging from his cocoon, and an entire life of bottling up my feelings burst to the foreground as I worked out and resolved my issues through video.
When Zachary met Maggie. The night I met my girlfriend Maggie was the true embodiment of luck favors the prepared, which itself is a corollary of fortune favors the bold, which I believe is the old tagline for Doritos. She approached me at a gay bar, the Abbey in West Hollywood, more specifically in the shared co-ed sinks outside the bathroom of a gay bar. Our eyes met, and I knew my night was about to change. You don't know this yet, but we're going to get married. I'm Dara. Huh? Right, okay. So that wasn't Maggie. It was a girl named Dara, whom I had never met before. Dara, as it turns out, was a fan of the Try Guys and a very friendly and forward one at that. I believe my super suave response was, "Oh, really?" Then another girl, Shannon, approached. She and Dara had met in the bathroom and become instant best friends, the way only young women seem capable of. It's pretty remarkable. How do you do it? Shannon, as I learned within 15 seconds, was here visiting a friend and was celebrating a breakup, but maybe shouldn't have taken a tequila shot from the bartender in the banana hammock with the nice abs. Behind them was Maggie, the most confused person I had ever seen in my life. What the hell was her best friend, Shannon, and new bathroom BFF, Dara, doing talking to me at a bathroom sink? Now, people often ask if Maggie knew who I was when we met, and the answer is no. I was just some weirdo in a bathroom. I had never seen someone's face scrunch up into a question mark before. She was beautiful, scrunched face and all. Neither of us remembers what we talked about that night. We've been back to that bar since, and we don't even understand how it's possible that we did talk. It is so impossibly, overwhelmingly, aggressively loud in there. But something, I said, must have worked. We spent the next hour locked in conversation. When the guys saw Maggie, they quickly understood why I'd gone missing. As the lights flashed on to tell people to start their sloppy migration home, though we were both sober, I know pointing that out makes it seem like more of a lie, but I promise we were. Maggie grabbed my hand to lead me through the crowd. Whenever I bring this up, she says it wasn't because she liked me, she just didn't want me to get lost. I counter that the fact that she didn't want me to get lost proves that she was totally into me from the start. Ha! Take that! She probably wasn't, but a boy can dream. Our early relationship was a blur. Normally, I was one to play the game, wait a few hours to text back, so as not to seem too needy. With Maggie, though, I threw all that out the window. I liked her. A lot. Plus, I was playing the role of this confident guy, so I just went for it. Also, games are stupid and they never work. Just be genuine. I texted her the morning after I met her. We had our first date 2 days later. We kissed for the first time and held hands on the way to dessert. I remember I made this joke about not wanting to give her my jacket, because then I'd be cold. Truth be told, I still think it was a totally hilarious reversal of classic gender norms that empowered her as a self-fulfilled woman. But apparently she thought I was kind of a dick for that. Hey, you win some, you lose some. And with luck, you learn to tell better jokes. After 4 months, I told her I loved her. I remember the day because we went to the beach. A big deal for me because I find sand to be a nuisance. It's tiny rocks and it gets everywhere and I don't understand what the big whoop is. Ooh, also, Pokemon Go had just come out and I caught an Electabuzz while sunbathing. A huge deal at the time. I don't know that I actually started with I love you. I'm pretty sure I hid my face under a towel and said, I think I'm falling for you. She laughed and said the same back, and only then was I able to confidently say the words I'd never said to anyone before. After that, I didn't have anything to fear ever again. Maggie changed my life. She taught me what it means to love and to be loved, and has filled my life with jubilation and purpose in a way that I've never felt before. We share a passion for live music and travel, and eating our way through cities. And, best of all, we have compatible food allergies. Two mutated weirdos, perfect for each other. She's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me, and I am grateful every single day that I decided to go pee the night we met. Meeting her allowed me to finally close the previous chapter of my life and start writing the next one.
If you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you gonna love somebody else? Rue fucking Paul.